WFAE Podcasting is funded by Corporate Information Technologies, helping businesses take a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 30,000 times a day, we take in and expel air, and along with it, everything it contains. For the most part, the air is invisible, but in reality, it's chock full of stuff, some good, some bad, some inert. Air also impacts almost every part of our lives and, according to our guest, has altered the course of human events in large and small ways more times than it would be possible to count. William Bryant Logan is an award-winning writer and a member of the faculty at the New York Botanical Garden, so it makes sense that he has written books in the past about dirt and oak. But after the first few pages, you come to quickly understand why his book, Air, The Restless Shaper of the World, also falls into his area of expertise, but we'll let him explain it. Mr. Logan joins us for the hour from New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
As I said, you've written about dirt and about oak trees, I imagine, now air. Where do the ideas to write books on such broad, amazing topics come from?
Partly just because they're things I've always loved, but I started doing dirt, well, back in the 90s when I first was in New York. I was brought up in California, and I spent a lot of time, most of my time, outdoors. I spent all summer hiking the Sierra. And, you know, I thought soil and dirt and trees and nature were primary things in my life. I got to New York City, and they kind of didn't even believe in them. And they would do the strangest things. I actually went to a lecture in which a man, an engineer, claimed that we could make trees better than nature. And I looked at this guy and I thought, what is he on? What is going on with him? And then I would go out on the streets in New York and people would be treating trees. We have a lot of street trees, and it's one of the reasons I finally got into taking care of trees. And they're in small pits. And people actually thought that in order to help the trees, they should add more soil, that the soil was the tree's food. So, and that was something that inspired me to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, 100 years ago, people understood far more about our relationship to soils than anybody does now. So I wanted to bring that back. I wanted to make it a living relationship again. And that's what I've done with all three books.
I know we're going to talk about air and not dirt, but so the soil is not a tree's food?
No, trees make their own food. They're, you know, we're heterotrophs. That means we eat other stuff. Trees and all their plants are autotrophs. That means they feed themselves. The food they make, they're making out of carbon dioxide, and they're making out of water, and they're making it into sugar, and they're using the energy of the sun to do that. Now, they take up a lot of stuff from the soil that's useful in doing that, but adding more soil, in fact, creates problems for trees because it basically drowns their roots. Their roots need to get oxygen, and when you add soil on top of them, you make it harder for that to happen. So trees, you know, basically asphyxiate.
So when you talk about nutrients in the soil for plants, you're not talking about food, or are you, for certain plants and not, but not for trees?
Well, we talk about plant foods, and that's kind of a rough way of speaking. What they are is elements that are necessary for the plants to make food, but for example, nitrogen. I mean, nitrogen is all over the air, but it's almost inert in the air. Only a few creatures, bacteria, are able to fix it into forms that plants can use, and it's thanks to them that we have plants and animals and all the rest of us. So, but that nitrogen is then recycled. As everything dies, it goes into the soil again. It is taken up again, and it's a very important element for plant growth, and without it, plants won't grow well, but that's not the food. It becomes a component of proteins that are made with the energy created when plants make food. So it's not exactly food.
So this latest book, Air, was described by your publisher as being part of the, quote, elemental trilogy that began with dirt and continued with oak. I'm just curious why it wasn't air, dirt, and water. How does oak fit into the trilogy as opposed to water?
Well, it's partly because I'm nuts about trees.
Okay.
and oak trees in particular. But it's a similar I may eventually get to water, though I'm not sure. My wife, who's a landscape painter, says, now you've done the three planes of landscape painting, the ground, the middle area, and the sky. So that's all you need to do. So she says I don't need to do any more, but I may. But the reason I did oak in the middle was, you know, in the Chinese system, there are five, not four elements, and one of them is wood.
Oh.
And I was interested in that, but I was also interested in oak trees because I came from California, I moved to New York, and yet there were oak trees in both places, but none of them were in common. All the species were different. And the more I learned, the more I found that oak is this world-traveling genus that's found through the whole temperate world. In no place it's not, and one of the most adaptable trees there is. And that really fascinated me, so I had to write about it.
There were things in this book that I knew would be in this book because it's about air, and you can think of a lot of different things that need the air, that use the air, that are made possible by the air, etc. And there are things in this book that I did not expect to find. It was kind of surprising. So it was clear to me early on that this is a really broad, all-encompassing topic. So when you face something like this as a writer, how do you begin? How do you organize it? How do you break it down into the individual pieces that you think are important, that not only inform, but that we understand as parts of the whole?
That's a very good question, and that's something I struggled with for more than a year in writing this. I kept thinking of different organizations, different ways to do it, and none of them worked. So I finally chose to do it by thinking of the different things that happen in the air: rising, falling, flying, calling, telling, shining. And so I just made those the chapter titles. And I began to find things because that's – I partly came to that because that's where my material was leading me. I find material partly just around me as I'm walking around. Also, I listen to a lot of people, and I try to make a lot of friends who know about things when I start to write about them. So one of my friendships that I developed in this book was a wonderful man who had been the New York State mycologist, that is the fungus man, for 37 years. So he had been in charge of studying fungi at the New York State Museum, and we struck up a friendship, and I learned so much from him about what travels invisibly in the air. So that's what I tended to do, was to find people who could kind of lead me into an area and then go on myself by meeting other people, by doing field work, by I really wanted to learn to fly as part of this. Mm-hmm. So I at least made the beginning of that, though I ran out of money, so I haven't got my license yet. But that's what I try and do, is just go and then go in the direction that it seems right at the time, much as the air, I think, moves.
What did learning to fly give you as a writer of this book about air that you didn't have before?
Boy, it gave me a visceral sense of, you know, I write a lot in the book about how the air is unpredictable. When you're flying in a small plane, you realize how unpredictable it is. And you also realize that it actually does behave in certain ways that you can influence both to help yourself and to hurt yourself. And one of the things I write about in the book that was most terrifying to me, although my teacher kept telling me how much fun it was stall practice. And I had studied all about aerodynamics, all about how, you know, why a wing goes through the air and what keeps it there. And I knew that if you passed what's called the critical angle of attack, that is if you were kind of your wing was too high up in the air, basically you would stall. And what happens when you stall is you stop getting that smooth flow over the wing, and the wing will basically go backwards and down instead of forwards and up. And it's one thing to think about that and another to actually feel it happening. It's really quite terrifying.
Because you're falling to the ground, right?
Well, you literally are. And you're falling. The weird thing is it's not like you're falling like a leaf. You're falling backwards. And because that's what happens. You've broken this. There's what's called a bound vortex that keeps a wing in flight. When you break that vortex, all of a sudden the drag forces, the forces that are drawing you down, outweigh the lift forces that are pulling you up and forward, and you go, whoa. And it really is like, and you know, my teacher thought it was fun. To him, it was a kind of roller coaster ride he's done again and again. To me, it was like, whoa. And then he said, after we were done, and I said, okay, I've done this five times each one. There are two kinds of stalls we do. Five times each one, that's enough. I think I'm going to stop now. And he said, well, you know, for your license, you don't need to do a spin recovery, but we could do that. I said, no, thank you. Not now.
So the purpose of doing that is to learn how to recover from it?
Yes, that's okay. The purpose in part. But for me also, it was a way to really experience the air, being in the air, mm-hmm. and being, you know, kind of at the mercy of it. The other way I did that was by talking to people who are pilots of non-powered planes or even hang gliders. I spoke to a wonderful hang glider who talked to me about her 20 or 30 years experience in the air and what she described as, at one point, as a friggin' handkerchief. meaning a hang gliding, right. Just as a hang glider.
Right. So, you know, when we pick up books that are written by people and we look at the flap, the jacket flap, and in your case it says author of Oak and Dirt, sought after lecturer and teacher and a practicing arborist. We know that this book is by an expert, and so we just assume that the expert knows everything and you're just imparting your knowledge to us. But you discovered lots of things you didn't know in the course of writing this book. What was the most surprising thing to you?
Oh, goodness. There were so many things. But I guess the most surprising thing was the very first thing, when I found out that all of this dust that I thought of, you know, I knew there was dust in the air. I knew that there had been dust that we caused tremendous dislocation in this country with the Dust Bowl and the dust that went through the air then. I knew that in ancient times after the last ice age that our productive soils had been blown there to where they are now, say in the Midwest or in the middle of Russia. And I knew that, you know, there were instances where pollution was causing problems. Like, for example, the dust coming off the Gobi could pick up so much residue and so many problems coming across the ocean that it would poison the breast milk of Inuit women in the Arctic. And I thought, this is very interesting. But I thought those were kind of isolated events. One thing that startled me in this book is that they're not. Huge amounts of dust travel around the world all the time. And they're responsible for things. Dust from the Sahara is responsible for the rainforests in Brazil, responsible for the fact that you can make clay pots on islands in the Caribbean, responsible for the southeastern pine forests in the United States. Without that constant transmission of dust across the oceans, we wouldn't have those things. I found that just amazing.
Yeah, you say dust is necessary, and that's one of the things that really leapt off the page for me, that the air carrying dust from North Africa makes the tropical rainforests of Brazil possible. Without that dust, they would not be possible. Why?
Because basically they have very old and very – because it's so rainy there too, their soils are highly leached. Most of the nutrients that you need to help the plant make food for a large tree, for example, are either not there or are tied up in forms the plant can't get, particularly phosphorus. So the fact that all these minerals are brought across the ocean and regularly dropped on that forest is what allows the trees and their epiphytes to continue growing, because they have that necessary – it's one of the major nutrients a plant needs. They get it from the Sahara.
So now when we think about dust in the wind, we think about pollution. And when you look at the dust storms that have taken place several times this summer in Phoenix, Arizona, these massive, enormous clouds of dust that just come in from the desert and blanket the city, is there something good in that we don't know about?
Well, it depends. There probably is something good from the point of view of a landscape. There may be. It depends on where the dust is coming from. Very often dusts now pick up pollutants. For example, the dust that come out of the Gobi Desert now in Mongolia pass across vast industrial areas on their way to Beijing. And when they get to Beijing, they are just full of toxics that are then inhaled by people with terrible results. One of the consequences of this is that the Chinese have declared their weather reports a state secret.
Yeah.
Because they don't kind of want people to know. And the American Embassy in Beijing continues to monitor the small particulates, the amount of them in the air that are coming out of these dust storms, and to let their people know about it. And the Chinese keep trying to get them to stop doing it because they don't want people to know that this fairly toxic material is coming into the city all the time. On the other hand, there are other dusts that are not toxic at all.
We have to take a break. I want to come back and talk about China's dust problem or pollution problem, because it does travel across the Pacific, and we're the next country to their right, I guess, if you look at the globe. We have to take a break. Our guest is William Bryant Logan. His book is called Air, the Restless Shaper of the World. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and WTVI, presenting Rock, Pop, and Doo-Wop, reuniting original legends of rock and roll for a one-time performance tonight at 8, WTVI, your community, your public television station. Well, you can tell that summer is nearing an end. The days are getting shorter, the air slightly cooler, and school starts next week for kids at CMS. Schools are opening with someone new at the helm, of course, Superintendent Heath Morrison. Changes have already been made. You can bet that more are on the way. So we're going to talk to a panel of journalists tomorrow who cover education in Charlotte to look at the year ahead and share their thoughts on what we may come to expect this year. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Republican Party platform calls for a constitutional amendment outlawing all abortions and toughens its stance on immigration. What the GOP platform represents and its impact on the Romney campaign.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. William Bryant Logan, our guest, the author of Dirt, the author of Oak, and the book we're talking about today, Air, the Restless Shaper of the World. We were talking about dust and how the Chinese government doesn't release weather forecasts about wind patterns because they don't want people in the cities to know about the pollution that's floating over them from these industrial areas out to, I guess, to their east, because weather does tend to move in the northern hemisphere, at least west to east. So I'm
west
wrong
to, east,
to the
yeah.
west, out to the west yep. of them. Now, if they're worried about cities to the east of the industrial areas, what about America? Because that air does float over the Pacific Ocean. What does it affect Hawaii? Does it affect the West Coast?
Well, it certainly does. That's probably the source of, you know, there have in fact been found elevated levels of pollutants and also of radiation in the breast milk of women, Inuit women in the Arctic.
Is that because of—
And that's almost certainly from the Gobi.
Is it really? Yeah. And what about Japan and their nuclear problem with the Fukushima plant?
That is certainly— – I don't know any data on that. Okay. It's certainly a good deal of that. I understand that certainly a good deal of that has appeared on the west coast of the United States. Now, of course, they tell us it's not in quantities that are dangerous, but I don't know the truth of that one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But certainly it depends on how high up you go with your dust is a very, very important factor in how far it will travel. So if you have a blast, for example, the old nuclear above-ground nuclear tests we did— – Mm-hmm. Those could be absolutely disastrous. And in fact, there's a wonderful writer who I just love, Terry Tempest Williams from Salt Lake City, who's a Mormon whose family came with Brigham Young to Salt Lake City area, wrote a wonderful book about partly about the drying of Great Salt Lake, but also about her family's struggles with breast cancer, which she came to see were closely related to the fact that they used to go and watch the nuclear tests. They would watch the flash. And, you know, and that stuff was in the above-ground nuclear test was shot right up to the stratosphere. And from there, it can circle the globe again and again and again. So a lot of the impact of whatever it is you put into the air has to do with how high you get it up there and also how small it is. So the smaller it is, the longer it can stay there.
You say that air is the great antagonist, that air stirs the pot, helping to change civilizations. And you point to the collapse of the Mayan civilization, the fall of the Tang Dynasty in China, the arrival of Viking colonists of Greenland. What is air's role in those events and others like them?
Well, there may be great, you know, sometimes shifts in weather occur that shift one way and then back the other, but sometimes whole shifts in the climate will occur. Now, we're doing some of that ourselves right now, but we're not the only agent that shifts the climate. And in the time of the Tang Dynasty and of the Mayan civilizations, there were major climate shifts that took rain away and prolonged droughts that basically destroyed agriculture, destroyed the beginnings of agriculture in those regions and caused so much social dislocation and starvation that people were no longer able to maintain themselves. The Tang Dynasty fell. The Mayans completely collapsed. The people in Greenland who, when the Viking colonists came to Greenland, it was aptly named Greenland. It was a nice new place to live, and many colonists appeared. But then the weather shifted. The climate shifted. It became much colder. The ice stayed much longer and kept them from going out in the water. And eventually they had to abandon it.
Hmm.
So a lot of things of that nature. And Kamikaze, the famous, you know, the Mongolians twice tried to invade Japan. And each time they did, they were prevented by major storms that swamped lots of their invading fleet. And that's where, you know, kamikaze was the name of the pilots the suicide pilots that the Japanese used in World War II, but that means divine wind. And kamikaze was originally, that was what it was named for, were the winds that destroyed the Mongol fleets.
But the things that you're talking about right now seem to be more weather than they are air. Are you equating air with weather or weather with air?
It's weather that brings – is air that brings the weather, rather. You don't have weather where you don't have air. And in fact, it's the motions of the air that cause all of what happens in climate and weather. So, you know, the air takes water up into it when water evaporates. Then that travels according to where the heat is. There's more heat towards the equator than at the poles. So air tends to rise where it's hottest and then head northward towards where it's cool. Way up north in the poles or south in the poles, where it's much cooler, air tends to sink and then to float along the ground southwards towards where it's warmer. So you get this circulation going south to north. And then because the Earth is spinning, it's that south to north has imposed on it a west to east direction. So this kind of spinning starts to occur because of the way the air moves, and that is the source of all our weather.
Hmm. When did we understand this?
Well, we
about
still
the
don't
weather.
Understand it.
Well, the fact that that air rises and it circulates in many different directions all simultaneously, and there are these vortices that happen, and the weather picks up moisture, it evaporates, it comes back down as rain. The clouds move across the sky in a west to east pattern, and highs and lows develop. When did we understand that?
Very gradually over a long period of time, but really basically most of the detailed understanding of it is a 20th century phenomenon. Particularly the fronts actually were a thing that were thought of. The reason we call them fronts is that a group of Norwegian meteorologists kind of thought up the whole idea of describing them as fronts during the First World War, and they thought of them as like the fronts in battle because they were places where warm and cold were meeting and in conflict, and then we'd see who wins.
Yeah.
So that's how we got the word fronts, and also that they made up all of what's familiar to all of us in looking at a weather map in the newspaper or wherever we're looking at it. All those symbols were made up by them in the early 20th century, and they thought they could then use mathematical formulas to predict the weather as far out as they wanted.
And they were wrong.
they were dead wrong, which is one of the most delightful things to me, is that, you know, the guy who proved them wrong was a man by the name of Edward Lorenz, who started out to be a mathematician. He was a great math whiz. He's the kind of guy who woke up in the middle of the night with equations in his head, wrote them down, and went back to sleep. And, you know, he came up with a number of interesting things in his dreams, basically. But he became a meteorologist, and it became a weather guy. And he was one of the ones who thought that, yes, I can massage these – what he called the dynamic equations, the equations of heat, temperature, moisture, motion that would govern the atmosphere. And if I do that, he thought, I can predict the weather as far into the future as you want. If you just give me a machine powerful enough to crack the numbers and keep up with the weather, I can do it. And he set out to prove that. And to his enormous credit, he proved conclusively that that will never, ever happen, and spent the rest of his life studying that, because the air is so various, the smallest thing can result in the largest changes just a few days down the line. He concluded that it will be impossible, even with the best measurements we could possibly ever have.
You know, we've heard these phrases, a butterfly flaps its wings in one place and the result is a hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. Is that true? You bring that up in the book a couple of times. Is that true? Do the smallest things result in sometimes these weather phenomena?
It's very likely is true. The other thing that's very likely true is that the same weather has never repeated once in the history of the world in any location.
Meaning what? The same weather.
The exact same weather pattern has never occurred. The same kind of combinations of moisture, of temperature, of rainfall in one given moment have never been repeated in the history of the world, that it's a continually varying it's hard to call it even a system. It's a stream, really, that continually flows in ways that are predictable only a short distance down the line. So whether anyone has ever measured what a butterfly's wing does, I doubt. But it's quite likely that that small an event can cause major changes, or a series of small events of that kind, because they multiply.
Which is why the guy you were talking about a second ago says we will never be able to accurately predict the weather more than 3 days out. So these 7-day, 10-day forecasts that we see on television are just guesses?
Well, they're better than guesses. They're likely going to go in that direction. But, you know, we can't say with any degree of certainty what's going to happen. And even within 1 or 2 days, we're still very often wrong, particularly about exactly what happens with the precipitation, whether it's going to be snow or rain, whether there's going to be freezing rain. And certain events like tornadoes and hurricanes are even harder to predict when they're going to occur. And
as you said, the 20th century is when we began to get an idea, of a slight understanding of how air and weather works. And they used weather or weather forecasting for the D-Day landings. And you write a whole chapter about how weather was analyzed, how it impacted the landings, how it impacted the success of the landings. Talk about that, because this really was – weather was important to that landing on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of the reasons I particularly liked writing about that was I think that the Allies, whose weather forecasts were far better, I think their forecasts were better because they acted more like the weather. What they did was they got three different teams of meteorologists, and they had each one make forecasts for whether the weather would be good enough for the landing on the day that it was originally planned. And the three fought like fury. They would call back and forth. They would call each other names. In fact, they called each other names decades later. They were still fighting with each other about this. And, you know, the very first time, you know, one of the teams, the American team, was quite sure that it was going to be great on the original day, not the day that D-Day occurred. It was not the originally planned day. Mm-hmm. It was planned a couple of days earlier than that. But two of the three teams said no. The weather's going to be too bad. Even though while they were making that prediction, the weather looked just fine. One of the teams, the American team, said, no, it's going to be fine. Don't worry. But 2-1, they lost. So it was just kind of like the weather in that there was this conflict of fronts, conflict of people with different ideas all fighting it out. And they came out with a forecast that said, no, you can't go on this day. And in fact, they were right. If they had gone on that day, D-Day would likely have been a disaster. The weather was abominable. They needed very particular conditions. They needed relatively clear sky. They needed winds force 5 or below, which is a measure of how fast the winds are. And they needed a low tide and a full moon. And they only had a couple of days in which they could do it. So this first time, you know, they said, no, there's going to be too much cloud cover, too much rain, too much wind. You can't do it. And they were right. And then a couple of days – so they said, okay, we're going to put it off. What's your forecast now? And then they went back to fighting, and they went back to squabbling, and they went back to yelling at each other. And finally, they said – two of the three said, okay, on the date that finally was D-Day, you can go. It's not going to be perfect, but it'll be good enough. And they were right. It was a little bit less imperfect than they thought. But in
Normandy, the Germans had their own forecasters. And they were looking at the same weather that was happening that the Americans and the British were looking at, and they thought there would be no landing that day because of weather conditions. And so they were off traipsing around Normandy, shopping. I think one of the generals was out shopping with his wife. They did not know that this was going to happen. I mean, they were confident that it wouldn't happen. Why?
I think partly because even though their lead forecaster was a great meteorologist named Heinz Lettow, who later came to the United States and was a revered professor at the University of Wisconsin until his retirement, has understood upper air phenomena as well as anyone who's ever lived. Great guy. But he was kind of all alone at the top there. They had this kind of hierarchical organization, and he had to make the prediction. But he had already been told by the high command that if the wind is force 4 or above, the Allies will not invade. So he felt confident. He was sitting there all alone having to make this forecast and said, well, yes, I think the wind will be force 4 or above, so therefore they won't invade because that's what I've been told. Whether he thought that was true or not, that's what he was told, and so that's what he predicted. And nobody asked the Allies.
And the irony of this is that the Allies had cracked the German codes, and so they were getting weather data from submarines, German submarines, because they knew how to crack the code. And that helped them predict the weather. What other factors? Because we didn't have satellites. We didn't have what we have today to measure atmospheric conditions over the oceans, what other – and that's where the weather was coming from in that case. So what other measures did they have to go by?
Well, there was actually just one of the things that made them change their forecast and think that they could go on the second day that was planned was one ship out near Iceland that started to report a rising barometer. And they kind of knew and they'd studied what weather patterns usually are year to year at that time of year in Northern Europe. And they thought, usually if something like that happens, it means that the high pressure system is moving in, that it will probably shunt the rain away, at least for a few days, shunt away the rain and clouds and steer them in a different direction. So it was kind of on that slender thread that they said, okay, let's go. They kind of had to. They had to make the decision because then they weren't going to have the full moon. They weren't going to have the low tide. They weren't going to have anything else they needed. So they were under tremendous pressure.
There are a lot of statistics in the book, and it's easy, I guess, to get bogged down. But the one that I liked a lot was that an individual takes 30,000 breaths a day. Humanity breathes about 8 trillion times an hour. But the rest of the world has us beat. You write that all of the air around us is actually the exhaled breath of other creatures, and 4/5 of it is the exhalations of microbes and plants. Wow. I don't have a question. It's just wow.
No, it is quite amazing that, at one point, I can't remember who I was talking to, but we decided that no planet within 20 parsecs has anything like this air. Now, I'm not sure how many planets we know of within 20 parsecs, but in any case, it's a very anomalous situation where these things called living beings are so influential on the atmosphere and in which the atmosphere is so crucial to them, but we are also crucial to the atmosphere. We're in this constant exchange with it. And I did a calculation of the breath on a 2,000-acre nature preserve in a day, and the numbers probably won't come to my mind right now, but it was astonishing the number of gallons of – it was something in the order of 10 or 12 million gallons of air exchanged a day on this 2,000-acre preserve by the creatures living on it.
Well, when we breathe in, we're bringing in whatever's in the air, and then when we exhale – Have we substantially changed the composition of that air that we've taken in, or do you know?
Well, we're letting out a great deal more. You know, we're taking
carbon
in,
monoxide.
We're taking in using the oxygen, and we're letting out the carbon dioxide, basically. Certainly other organics come out with us, and we only use about 60% of the oxygen that comes in, so a lot of it goes back out again. And then a lot of the aerosols, a lot of the invisible things, the dusts in the air, may actually sometimes lodge in our lungs, though our lungs have tremendous and our airways have tremendous means and methods for getting rid of things that might do them harm like that, of filtering them out. Either there's kind of a little ladder of hairs that if something catches on the hairs going down, the hairs will then pass them back up to the glottis and drop them into the stomach. So there are a whole lot of ways that the lungs prevent this from happening.
I only have 30 seconds left in this segment, but just how many things are that we can't see are in the air? Because I said, you know, the air is chock full of stuff all the time. Do we know how many things are in the air at any given moment on average?
Well, I have a basketball. I tried to work with a guy to figure out a basketball-sized chunk of air in New York City in the spring. We figured about 166,500 particles of invisible material in that small part of air.
And you went out on the Brooklyn Bridge? And measured? We'll talk about that when we come back, because you went out with an instrument that you've kind of devised or other people have taught you how to make and just measured the stuff in the air. We'll talk about that when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and James McElroy and Deal, a law firm providing litigation and business counsel to companies and individuals for more than 50 years. Details at jmdlaw.com. The Republican Party platform calls for a constitutional amendment outlawing all abortions and toughens its stance on immigration. What the GOP platform represents and its impact on the Romney campaign, the topic of the discussion at 10 o'clock this morning on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us to talk about air, your chance to be on the air, Is it 704-926-WFAE? That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or if you just want to have things float through the air without your voice attached, online, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
You know, you get attached, but it is still just a thing. And we started thinking, well, we could trade it in, but we probably wouldn't get a whole lot of money for it. And we thought, who deserves this vehicle? And we said, hey, public radio deserves this vehicle. My name is Bruce Yelton, and I donated my GMC Safari to public radio.
Learn more at WFAE.org. And thanks.
Dust in the wind, all they are is dust in the wind.
Say it's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7, WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's in the air, or the air itself. Air, the restless shaper of the world, is the name of William Bryant Logan's book, and he's our guest this hour on Charlotte Talks. We talked about things being in the air. The air is full of things that we can't see. And you went out on the Brooklyn Bridge with an instrument that you were taught how to make and just held it up into the air and came back and put it under a microscope. What did you find in that air that looks completely clean to us?
Yeah, I was expecting not to find very much alive. I was right in the middle of the Brooklyn Bridge above the lanes of traffic and thinking I would get mostly black carbon from tailpipes or from little bits of tire, and I got all kinds of stuff. I got all sorts of different fungal spores. I got pieces of protoplasm. I got little bits of moths and butterflies have scales on their wings, and those often come off, and they look like these tiny little purple wisp brooms. All sorts of fungi. I got also little bits of blue jean fiber, all kinds of things, and a good deal of black carbon. There was a lot of stuff that had come out of people's tailpipes, but not exclusively that. And most interestingly, a bunch of blobs. And I learned later when I was asking people about it that they were fat, which is the most common aerosol in the air in New York City.
Fat? From what source, though? Cooking?
Yeah, probably from the number of restaurants. And, you know, we have tremendous amounts of food carts out on the street. And, you know, it's a very concentrated area of people all cooking. Yeah.
So you think about all that stuff that we can't see, all these very different things that are floating around the air. We take it, we breathe it in. Some of it has to stay inside. Some of it must stick in our lungs and then get transported to other parts of our body. Why aren't we all dead?
Well, some of it, I think, is transported and excreted. A lot of the stuff, as I say, will be passed back up our gullet and then dropped down into our stomach and be excreted. Some of it that does get into our bloodstream may indeed be causing things. We're not quite sure, but we're thinking a lot of people are now studying, for example, what happened after the 9/11 events here in New York City. And, you know, of the people who went to help at the World Trade Center, like 60,000 to 70,000 people, 40,000 of them have sought medical attention. So obviously there's a lot more going on there than we were told or we thought at the time. Mm. And one of the things they're starting to study is, well, what's the fate of these? What happens to these particles that people breathed in? Because it was a tremendous dust event. I went with my tree company to a place nearby to take care of some of the plants we had to a couple of weeks after the events. And we immediately, you know, we're tree people, so we carry masks for applying pesticides. We immediately put our masks on. We couldn't breathe. It was painful to breathe there. But they had told us the air was fine. Well, as it turns out, it wasn't fine. And a lot of the things that happened were just particles, not necessarily toxic in themselves, but lodging in the lungs. They were small enough to lodge in the tissue of the lungs and then cause inflammation. And, you know, as a pulmonologist described it to me, you know, our bodies evolved to deal with wounds. Like you'd get a cut, and when you got the cut, there would be inflammation to prevent infection, and then there would be a scar to scar it over, and that's how we dealt with wounds. So the lungs behave as though they were receiving a wound when they get one of these pieces of junk stuck in them, and they may then inflame, and after inflaming, scar over. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of, from these kinds of inhalation diseases, we're seeing a lot of fibrosis, development of these fibers in the lungs, or alternatively, if they get so irritated that the tissues die, of holes in the lungs like emphysema.
So this is not unlike what happens to a person who works in a coal mine and breathes in coal dust for his career, and not unlike what happened to a lot of textile workers who worked in these plants where lint was just prolific in the air, and I guess not unlike what happens to people who've been smoking for 30, 40 years.
Exactly.
So,
and, you know,
Go ahead.
No, it's also a serious problem throughout the developing world. There are a lot of people who live in houses that are poorly ventilated, and they use whatever they've got. They use wood, or they use dung, or they use leaves to heat and to cook in their houses. And the mothers and children there, there are numbers of mothers dying of emphysema who've never smoked in their lives. They're just breathing the air inside their houses.
But now the EPA, shortly after 9/11, said that the air and water in New York was safe to breathe and drink. Obviously, they were wrong. it didn't take a rocket scientist to look at that cloud of smoke coming from the collapsing towers to realize, oh my gosh, that stuff is it's going to be everywhere for a long, long time. So if they were wrong, why were they wrong? Where and what should they have been measuring?
Well, one thing that they weren't paying enough attention to, I think, was just the amount of what I was just talking about, of just the dusts in the air, of things like powdered particle board. A lot of plastic turned into things called, when it burned, turned into things called carbon nanotubes, these tiny, tiny little, very slender diameter long tubes. And those being inhaled, although they were not, you know, what the EPA was looking for was things, their dioxins, things that could be toxic in themselves. And they weren't. They also didn't take, for some reason, air samples. They took samples of stuff that had already settled on the ground at the very beginning. Later, they were taking air samples.
Do you think that was deliberate? Do you think that was by design so that they wouldn't panic the populace?
Well, I think it was partly that they'd never experienced anything like this, and they didn't know what to do. I don't think they were very imaginative about how to do it. In fact, some people at NYU, a ways away, who were just allergists, said, oh, okay, let's do some air samples. And they did indeed, in fact, do air samples immediately and found out what was happening.
Do we know what, if any, impact there has been from those collapsing towers in other parts of the world? Because weather does travel usually west to east, so it would cross Greenland into England and Europe. So did it get there? Have there been any problems as a result of it?
I think unlikely. I think as terrible as a thing as it was in New York, I think that there wasn't – by the time it had reached across the Atlantic, it would have been a tiny amount compared to, say, the dust that comes from the Sahara each year, just a tiny amount.
And, of course, you write about the function of the ocean and all this. A lot of this stuff falls into the ocean and is buried deep below it. A lot of the stuff in the air just falls onto the surface of the ocean and is eaten by tiny ocean creatures. Correct?
Yeah, by plankton. Yeah, without a good deal of the minerals that are required by plankton to live are blown there by dust. So, you know, this idea that there are all of these sovereign individuals living alone and occasionally things happen to them just doesn't work out. I mean, it turns out that everything is connected to everything else, and the Sahara is feeding plankton in the oceans.
Let's take a couple of phone calls for our guest today, William Bryant Logan, author of Air, The Restless Shaper of the World. Walter in Harrisburg, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. My question is about the one part of the atmosphere that conducts electricity well. Tesla figured out you could send electricity with no loss of power, and he actually figured out the distribution of wireless electricity, and it never got off the ground. And I was wondering if it had got off the ground in the 1900s, if that would have affected the weather, you think? You know anything about that?
That's a very interesting question, and no, it's not something that I've considered. How would electrical transmission affect the weather? Probably not, probably because most of the systems operating, most of the things that keep the weather moving are things to do with – so if it affected temperatures, it would indeed, because temperature and water vapor contents are major players in the atmosphere as well as the turning of the Earth. So if indeed electrical transmission had that effect of changing temperature in the atmosphere, it might well affect it. Otherwise, I don't think so.
Thank you, Walter, for your question. You know, since the early beginnings of wireless communication, back when they called radio the wireless, we talked about these sounds floating through the air, radio and television signals floating through the air. And at any given time, there are all these signals going through the air. But really, these are signals. These are light signals. These are all, aren't they? Aren't broadcast transmissions really light waves?
Yes, I think they are.
Okay, so if they're light waves, what? And I know that air plays a role in how we perceive light. Do these light waves have any impact on the air, or does the air have any impact on light waves? It does have an impact on AM radio transmission. I know that.
Yeah, it certainly does, because the changes in the air affect how far radio signals will travel. I'm not sure whether or not there are effects of light wave type transmissions on weather in the air. It's an interesting question. I'm
okay.
Not sure.
There's some things that are just not going to be in this book.
No, I'm afraid not. That's where I got it.
That's okay.
I ran out. You know, it took me 4.5 years. I realized I could have gone on for another 5, but I said, no, I have to finish. Besides, my editor also said, no, you have to finish this thing.
Mary in Belmont, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I live in an area of Belmont that is adjacent to Lake Wylie. And as you well know, Mike, we do have coal ash ponds here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very concerned about the transport of this coal ash to another area. They transport it probably 12 miles away. They cover it up with trucks, but there are coal ash particles that blow all over the place. I myself have been behind the trucks and had the hood of my car covered with this. I'm trying to figure out what the impact that would be on the environment, for instance, the homes that are closest to the road, and the impact on the water, which is not too far away.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't know what the size of those particles are. It sounds like they're pretty heavy, so they may not go very far. But for people who are within the range that they do go, it could have a serious health impact, I would think. Is there no study of this going on?
Well,
are there no regulations?
Duke Power, of course, is the governing power of these coal ash ponds. And, you know, they have tested the water, and there have been, Mike, correct me if I'm mistaken in how I portray this, but they have found some arsenic levels within the water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, apparently it's not so high that it could be a problem to the population. But I'm more concerned about the roadside issues, because it seems like these trucks are not covering. They do attempt to cover their load, but obviously, unless it's a sealed cover, you know, you're going to have little particles blowing out here and there.
Of course, the air is dirty anyways, and I mean, we talk about dirt in the air being pollution, but all the billions of things that are in the air at any given time, you'll never breathe completely clean air, will you? Except unless you're working in a clean room.
Yeah, no, you won't. And not only that, every time the rain falls, most of the rain that falls, not all of it, but I would say 90% of the rain that falls is actually a solution between water and the aerosols in the air. So certainly there's always something in the air besides just a water and gaseous elements.
So don't drink the rain and don't eat the snow.
Yeah, I don't know. Most of it's okay, but you know, sulfates from coal are another question. So it's an interesting question, and I would follow up and see what the people say about it.
We'll have to get some scientists on here whose area of expertise is that, Mary.
Love it.
Okay.
I would love it.
Right.
I'd eat it up in a day.
Okay. Right. Careful what you eat now. All right. Thanks. Bye bye.
True. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. John and Charlotte, welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm fascinated by this. A lot of my work involves air particles and the movement of the air particles and the contents of the air in dealing particularly with mold. And it's amazing to me the phenomenon that has taken place over the past 18 years since the mid-90s when we had that case down in Texas that raised so much publicity about the mold, black mold, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of knowledge of people... If they see a little bit of mold growing in their house, they think they're going to die. And I try to explain to them that every house has somewhere between about 500 to 1,000 mold spores in every cubic meter of air in the house.
Absolutely.
And when you look at the slides, you see a lot more stuff that's in there, of course. And so I'm delighted to hear you talking about this and trying to get the public aware of this sort of thing.
You actually talk in the book about indoor air pollution, particularly in the modern world, not the third world, where we always think they're living in a polluted environment. We, with our tightly sealed homes, are living in a polluted environment, and a lot of it has to do with what we bring into the house.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and not necessarily
clothing and feet,
right,
and all that sort of thing. Yeah, can't keep it out.
John, thank you for your call. I appreciate
it. You're
very
welcome. Uh-huh.
To talk more about that, William Logan.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, people are all afraid of molds. In fact, my friend, the state mycologist, is one of the people who's kind of called on to testify about that. But most of the molds, most of the fungi that we experience in the house or bacteria are not dangerous to us.
In fact, you say they're a good thing because without them, we would be drowning in megatons of the dead.
Absolutely.
What does that mean?
Because they're the main decomposers. The fungi and bacteria are the main decomposers in this world. So when things die, they're the ones who recycle the material so that we can use it again. They're the ones who are in a compost pile, make the compost pile work, are the fungi and the bacteria in it. So they're very, very crucial organisms. Some of them happen to be toxic to us, but a very small number.
Hmm.
But what was the question that you just asked was about other things in indoor air.
Yeah.
It's often not the fungi or the molds. And this is an area that's still very much a lot more remains to be known about. But what we're finding is that our modern methods of manufacturing, things like furniture, adhesives, paints, rugs, cause all kinds of these. They look just like the rugs of 100 years ago or the chairs of 100 years ago, but they aren't. They're full of all these composite materials, which are really quite wild and have possible toxins in them.
Yeah, that new car smell is not a good thing. It smells great, but it's not a good thing. Well, we didn't talk about scents, we didn't talk about a lot of things, but you'll have to get the book, Air, The Restless Shaper of the World, by our guest this hour, William Bryant Logan. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.